First of all, I'd like to apologize for not being Bob. I know a lot of you are fans of Bob's and came here to see him speak, but unfortunately he was unable to make it. It's kind of funny for me to give the talk because Bob has kind of taken aspects of what is going on in California organic industry and put it into a nice talk, and we've done a paper together. But I'm on the other side. I work in organic farming in California. I work for a company that grows lots of organic salad every day of the year, and that's my introduction here. So here's Bob's big. Well, let's see. Let me just do this here. Okay. So here's Bob's big introduction here. Only he could pull it off, so I'm not gonna even try. But on the central coast of California, everybody's gone surfing. So Bob is at UC Davis at the UC Sustainable Agriculture and Research and Education Program. And I work for a producer company, Mission Organics, which produces leafy greens and lettuces, cole crops, for the largest salad producer in the United States, Earthbound Farms. And we'd like to thank the many people that sort of have worked on this project. Bill Cheney, Kent Dane, Sam Earnshaw, Rosemary, love all, Eric Nelson, Beverly Ramsey, and Hugh Smith. Also, Bob gave me this talk about a day and a half ago, and it's got 125 slides in 25 minutes, so it's kind of mission impossible. But I'll get to the gist of the message. So here on the Central Coast, or over on the Central Coast, west of here, is one of the most productive areas in California. It's got a crop season that goes from January to November, basically, in terms of planting to harvest. And some pieces of ground get as many as three to four rotations of crops on it. And this has driven up high lease rates and so forth. The other thing that has happened is it's been sort of consumer driven, but there's been a large growth of the organic industry on the coast. And I think they're in excess of 10% of the vegetable production now on the Central Coast is probably organic production. And here's an example. There's many difficult problems we face, especially aphid control. And there's been a variety of adoptions to try to deal with aphid problems. And this is a kind of a blend of different flowering crops to attract aphid predators. And there's annual buckwheat, cilantro, and sweet alyssum. And long ago, there was more windbreaks in the Salinas Valley, but most of these, as indicated on the slide, had very little insectary value. So these crops I kind of already reviewed. There's a variety of different crops. They're all sort of leafy vegetables, so there's no actual flowers for most of these crops. So there's really a lack of pollen and nectar in the systems. And there's lots of various definitions for pests, including aphids for us are generally a contaminant pest. So there's a variety of different pests we face in our various crops, and today I'll be mostly focusing on the cabbage aphid and the lettuce aphid. And fortunately, there's a lot of natural enemies that attack lettuce aphid or aphids in general. So this is the lettuce aphid Nasonovia ribus nigri. It was introduced to California about 10 years ago or so. It hasn't been here for long. It's an especially difficult problem because it inhabits the very center of the plant, which makes it really kind of impossible to treat with organic materials. Conventional farmers have synthetic or systemic insecticides they use, which takes care of the problem, but we don't have anything like that organically. This is an example of one of our fields. This is a shot I took, and probably the main insectary plant we've used has been Sweet Alyssum for a variety of reasons, primarily because it flowers very quickly, within 4 weeks generally. It's highly attractive to our surfeit complex, to the adults that is, and it flowers through the duration of the crop. So it's got its biggest punch when we really need it. And in addition to sort of growing lettuce, this is actually sequential plantings. This is the oldest lettuce over here, and it gets younger and younger. And so we really are not only farming lettuce, but we also are farming surfeits. And as they become established here, generally it gets easier and easier as you go along. So the cabbage aphid is a very similar problem that we face. And this should be Brevicarinus. This is a PDF, so I was unable to do any modifications. Just blame Bob. Now, jumping back to generalists, there's a lot of generalist predators that you would find in all of our cropping systems. And these are some that Bob's listed here. Basically, the crop has to begin, it's such quick turnover that everything has to colonize both the pest and the natural enemy. So it sort of favors, colonizing generalists. Here's some work that Bug and Wilson did, 89, showing that you can get a large complex of generalists that will predate on Lepidopteran eggs. Some other work Bob did in Tifton, Georgia, different region, different complex of generalists. Some work from Woodland in the Sacramento area where he had okra and zucchini, and again you see a big contribution by generalist predators. This is one of the most common generalist predators we see in our cropping systems, Geocaris atricolor. It's maybe not so common other places, but it's mostly soil dwelling, and it is very rapid moving, and it feeds on a wide range of various arthropod pests. Tamaki was one of the first researchers to see the virtues of Geocaris as a predator. And I'll just go through some slides of Geocaris. This is Geocaris pallens, which is also very common on the coast. And it's here feeding on beet army eggs. This is Geocaris pallens nymph feeding on a corn earworm egg. Another photo. This is Geocaris punctipes. It's a larger, slower moving one that's more abundant inland, and we generally don't see it on the coast. Here it's feeding on omnivorous leaf roller eggs. And this just kind of summarizes some of the differences between the three Geocaris species that are most common here in California. So pallens is smaller, faster, very common. Atricolor is less common inland, but common on the coast, and it's very visually aware. It'll drop if you get near it to the ground and hide. And punctipes is the largest, and it generally higher up on the plant and slower moving. And these are just some illustrations. Geocaris, punctipes, pallens. And then these are some carabid species that are known to feed on nectar, even though they are, you know, generally ground dwelling. Another carabid. Here's a photo I took. Pretty much, if the bug's on lettuce, it's from the paper we did recently, which I'll post later in the talk here. But this is our most abundant native coccinellid. It's predaceous as an adult, so it's maybe less reliant on flowery nectar compared to some of the other natural enemies I'll show you. Here's a larval shot, Hypotamia convergens. And the next most abundant, or maybe the most abundant at times, is the seven-spotted lady beetle, Coccinella septipunctata. And this is an introduced species from Europe that is becoming more and more common as time goes on. This is a shot of the larval stage, which is larger than our native and can be very aggressive. This is an adult Hemerobius pacificus. It's also more common than in most cropping systems inland. The brown lacewing will often colonize a similar area that we see syrphids in the very center of the plant. In fact, here's a picture of a brown lacewing larva, which is sometimes you can easily confuse with a lacewing larva because it occupies the same part of the plant. Not a lacewing larva, but a syrphid larva. Lacewing larvae are usually more on the outer parts of the plants. Here's a photo of a brown lacewing feeding on soap bark tree. There's a close-up of it. This is same tree, soap bark tree, with green lacewing, Chrysoperla carnea, the most common species on the coast we see. And this is here's Chrysoperla carnea feeding on cilantro. And this is the Chrysoperla carnea larva stage. And this is common. You'll see it on the outside of the plant generally. The inside of the plant where the lettuce aphid mostly inhabits, these are less important for us. So now I'll review the syrphids that we have in our system. I guess the unique thing about the syrphids is they tend to be pretty consistently good biocontrol agents through the entire system and over a range of regions on the central coast. And we've been doing some work. Bill Cheney and Hugh Smith did a lot, and then I helped Bob a little bit with this last publication, basically matching up adults with larvae. This is Spherus foreus sulfuripes. It's pretty common all season long, is same as Allegrapta obliqua. And there's a number of people on the coast that are doing research, at least in some part, associated with syrphids. This is Allegrapta obliqua. It's also a very common species we see. Here's Allegrapta obliqua feeding on alyssum flowers. And this is a dark morph that might throw you off that's seen occasionally. It's rare. This is a more high-density specialist, Platycerus stagnus. It's something that lays eggs in clutches, usually near a large colony of aphids. This is Eupioides americanus. It's a large syrphid species that is probably the most common one we see in coal crops like broccoli and cauliflower. And it's a different looking. It's gray and it's spiky. This is the largest species of surfeit that we see on the coast. This is Scavia pyrastri. It's large. The stripes almost look white out in the field. And this is another Eupioides fulacris that is less common, more of a springtime species. And this one's very similar to Eupioides americana. It's a large, striped, common throughout the season, and more common during high densities. And this is the Toxomeris occidentalis. These become extremely abundant in the later part of the season. And usually when we see these build up in our habitat strips, it ensures that we're going to have an easy time dealing with our aphid problems. So I guess the strips also work well for us as a monitoring tool. When we see a lot of adults foraging on the alyssum, we tend to also see good surfeit activity out in the field. This is Allegrapta obliqua on one more time. This is the Eupioides americanus. This is the one that we see mostly in coal crops, and it's here in a cabbage aphid colony. This is most likely the larval stage of Eupioides fulacris. It's one that is not as common in our production. This is the larval stage of Platycera stagnus, which is the one that lays eggs and clutches that feeds on high density aphid colonies. And this is the large surfeit larva, Scavia pyrastri. The larval stage of Spherosporia sulfuripes. And this is the larval stage of Cerphius opinator. And Toxomeris occidentalis. So this graph depicts a real common dynamic that we see in most fields. You'll have a buildup of aphids, and generally almost every one of our lettuce fields, we have sort of levels of aphids that exceed what we can sell at harvest. So it's a very common pest, and basically we rely on this predator-prey cycle to occur just about every time we grow lettuce. So it's a pretty unusual situation. I guess this system is really kind of an exception rather than the rule for biocontrol. It seems like it's consistent conservation biocontrol that's working. And we've done this on well over 10,000 acres now over the years. So it's pretty an amazing system. This is a graph showing surfeit larvae, hoverfly larvae, larvae here, and then the aphid population density here. And this is something we don't see in every field, but generally you see more surfeits adjacent to the alyssum strip initially and fewer aphids. But this pattern is almost always transient. It's there and then it's gone, and things can change very fast. So you can go from a field that's got this sort of pattern to one that's got just about no aphids and just surfeit larvae quickly. Here's the feather-legged fly, the parasitoid of the squash bug. Also feeds heavily on flower. This is a buckwheat flowering strip here. And these are stuff that Bob threw in, I think, that have been well covered in previous talks. This is just a graph showing how diadagma has very different longevity periods depending on the nectar source. And like we've seen, sweet alyssum comes out high on the list. Spiders, also known to feed on nectar. Here's a clubionid. Here's a dwarf spider, which is also known to feed on nectar and a good, but very little studied. We don't know a lot about these guys. So this is another part that Bob threw in that is maybe less germane to this topic, talking about some of the complications to biological control and how we could have intraguild predation where you might have a good mixture of natural enemies, but you can have things thrown off due to predators eating predators. And this just reviews Jay Rosenheim's and colleagues' research looking at green lacewing feeding on aphids in cotton. The cotton system also has assassin bugs that are large sit-and-wait predators that do not feed much on aphids. And this graph shows how lacewings do well when they're by themselves. You put them in combination with hemipteran predators, and you see almost elimination of lacewings with these large hemipteran predators. And where lacewings are eliminated, you generally have a resurgence of aphids, and where lacewings are alone, they tend to be quite good at controlling aphids. This is the cotton system and the cotton aphid. So pollen and nectar are one important part of having additional habitat, but there are many other things that insects need. There's overwintering sites, mating sites, shelter, etc. And so biodiversity not only provides maybe more food sources, but it could also provide greater structure out in the environment so that with greater plant complexity, you have more niches for herbivores and natural enemies. So in my experience, this is another shot of one of our fields. What's been most important for predicting whether a location will have good biological control, one is if we have effective flowering strips that are producing lots of nectar and pollen for our syrphids to eat. The other thing that really helps syrphids to be more consistent is if we have these riparian strips that are nearby a ranch or a farm. And these strips really do, the areas where we have these strips, we tend to have much more consistent biological control. And this is a strip with barley, where we're using barley to harbor non-pest aphids that are used to attract our syrphids that way. And Eric Nelson and Kent Dana are doing research currently on this topic. So I'm out of time just about, but I wanted to just mention that hedgerows are another area that have potential, although at this time, I'm not sure if we can say that a hedgerow is doing the same sort of habitat function that like a riparian strip does. And so that's an area that needs more work. And I guess I just got to get to this one section too, because this is kind of Bob's his brainchild that someday maybe will get implemented, is using culinary herbs that you can harvest and use as a cash crop, but that are also providing insectary potential for a grower. And I think I'll just cut it off there. If there's any questions, yeah. It's a...